If you don't have a compass as to who you're trying to talk to, and if you don't have a sharp understanding of the values that you bring to whatever industry you're in, you're kind of shooting in the dark. You know, you may occasionally hit a target, and that's, you know, sometimes the way a lot of small businesses start out. But if you're scaling, it's just not good enough. When there's no strategy behind it, it's just for the aesthetics themselves and not for the broader ideal of what you're trying to do. When you have those foundations in terms of your value proposition, a well thought out mission statement, a good understanding of what your values are, really strongly planned goal prioritization, then you are setting the foundation for a lot of forward movement.
Check 1, 2, check 1, 2. We've got levels. That means we're on. Welcome to Rel and Friends. It is I, Rel, and this is the podcast where we hope to empower and encourage creative professionals like yourself. Or maybe you're sitting in a car with someone who is a creative who wants to listen to the podcast, and hopefully you'll like it too. But if you don't, pass it along. Today, you'll be hearing a conversation with my friend Cliff Washington. Cliff comes from a background of traditional art, graphic design. He shares stories of early days of him discovering what graphic design was, and also a hilarious L moment. His response for when I asked him about his biggest L moment is pretty great. And if I could, I would want to make a skit out of it because it's hilarious. Sorry, Cliff. Maybe it's traumatizing for you, but I thought it was really funny. We've also got some great stories. Neo, R&B artist, has some words for the AI robots about what's happening to the music industry. I think AI is just going to be a recurring subject here because it impacts us so much and something is changing every single day. So I will be doing my best to keep you up to date on what I hear. But there's a lot of news happening all the time, so I'll try my best to filter out the best that relate to us. Also, the paint company Sherwin-Williams has appointed someone notable in the hip-hop game as their creative director, an OG in the fashion game up for hip-hop. We'll get into that a little bit more later. And I want to give a little bit of my thoughts on this big three thing happening. J. Cole, K. Dot, or Drizzy, who do you got? I'll tell you who I got later. But before we get into it all, I need to tell you guys, you need to do me some big favors, okay? And I do this every week at the top now because it's working. You need to follow on any and all major platforms where you listen to podcasts. Follow. You need to rank us number one. You need to comment. I think I've only gotten one comment. It's from someone I know. You need to comment. And most important, you need to leave a voicemail. The voicemail number is 646-926-3885. We've got a good one today. We've got a really good voicemail here today. That's coming up at the end. Because it's another one where I need to think. And if you follow the podcast, I'm not good at thinking. So that'll be coming up later in the show. Welcome to Rel and Friends. All right, y'all. Welcome. We are entering the second week of April, rounding out Q2 pretty soon. How's it going for y'all? You enjoying it? Making some progress there with your projects? This is how it usually goes with me. The first 3 months of the year are usually really slow for me. And I start to freak out because nothing's coming in. I had some projects. I'm actually wrapping up one project with Chime. Shout out to Chime. And I got Rory and Maul. But usually by the end of March, I start freaking out. Like, where are these gigs? No one's hitting me up. Am I good the rest of the year? What's happening? And then I get like 5 emails at the same time. And then I go from freaking out because nothing's coming to freaking out because too many things are coming. Good problems to have, great problems to have, and we're going to tackle everything. We're going to kill it like we always do over here, artist storytelling, because we got the manpower, yeah. We got the knowledge, yeah. And this is what we do. Sorry, got hype. But yeah, so there's a lot coming up. I think May, I'm going to be nonstop, so I have 2 trips, one to Vegas and looks like another one to LA. They're both week-long trips, so I will definitely be doing some podcasts on the road. Stay tuned for that. And I think we might squeeze in a break at the end of this month because we deserve it. I might take the last 2 weeks to take a little break from the podcast. Speaking of break, let's get into some news. Now, Neo recently did an interview on CNN where he spoke out about the impact of AI and his thoughts about how AI is being used in the music industry.
I look at AI the way I look at fire, right? Now, with fire, you can warm a home, you can create a beautiful home-cooked meal, but you can also burn a house down with fire. So it's not necessarily that it's a bad thing. It's a bad thing depending on how it's being used. And my challenge to the people creating AI is, show me the positive aspect of this. Show me what positivity is going to come from being able to not only take my voice, but take my writing style, take my whole likeness, my everything, and do with it whatever the hell y'all want. Like, show me the positive aspect of that. That's all I'm saying.
Well, they would say, well, we're able to have creativity, but you would obviously think that it's stifling or trying to make obsolete the true human creatives.
How is it creative to mimic me? Where's the creativity in that? You're basically just doing your best impression of me. I don't see the creativity in it.
You know, obviously he didn't listen to that Drink Champs episode with the DLC. If you remember in the last episode, I mentioned how the DLC mentioned that he can potentially make songs again if he retrieves his original masters. So if you don't know, he lost his voice in a car accident many years ago. And if he got his masters, he would be able to use AI technology to create new songs. So that's a very positive aspect of using AI in the music business. So yeah, it's all really interesting. I understand Neo's side, but at this moment, like, I love the idea of being able to record new songs with some of the greats. Now, those that passed away, do I want to hear new songs from people that passed away? I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think I would want it to do something like that. So it's all such a weird situation, but hey, this is where we're at right now. And in other news, the paint company Sherwin-Williams has officially named Dapper Dan the creative director of its new The Loneliest Color campaign. Now, this is a campaign to highlight the color Kingdom Gold. So this is a gold color that Sherwin-Williams has that they want to promote. And they're using our OG, Dapper Dan, to do it.
Rediscovering the beauty of color means going to the essence of what something is and what it looks like. Being the creative director of The Loneliest Color for Sherwin-Williams is the hallmark of my career.
What you're teaching with this collection is how to use this color in an amazing way. Like, your combinations of color are unexpected.
They asked me to recreate what I was doing in their colors, and I was happy to do that, especially the Kingdom Gold. So you put more emphasis on the Kingdom Gold. It just accentuates everything.
Now, if you know the history of Dapper Dan, he originated the all-over print Gucci suits, Louis suits. So if you wanted a custom, you know, jacket pants in the Fendi pattern, you went to Dap for that. And he's from Harlem, New York. He eventually did stuff with Gucci officially after like 30 years. And this campaign is weird to me, man. Are they using our OG here for just to promote a color, or are they really going to have him step in as a creative director? Dapper Dan said that he has never been appointed a creative director before. So let's see. Like, if they are dropping a clothing line, I don't know if I'm going to be wearing any Sherwin-Williams clothes. I don't care how limited it is. But yeah, let's hope that he actually gets a say, because OGs still fly. If you got to check out these pictures. Clap. Now let's talk big three. The big three. I decided I want to start talking about this on the podcast because I have not been as excited for any kind of MC competition. I'm not going to say beef because this isn't really beef. I haven't been excited to follow any kind of MC competition since it was probably Drake Meek Mill. But this one's interesting. So, to get you up to speed, if you're not up to speed,
Love when they argue the hardest MC. Is it K-Dot, is it Aubrey or me? We the big three like we started a league. But right now I feel like Muhammad Ali.
K-Dot on Future's album sent out some shots talking about the big three and saying, it's just Big Me.
Fuck sneak this in first person shooter. I hope they came with three switches. I crash out like fuck rap. This Melly Mel if I had to. Got two T's with me. I'm snatching chains and burning tattoos. It's up. Lost too many soldiers not to play it safe. If he walk around with that stick, it ain't Andre 3K. Think I won't drop the location. I still got PTSD. Motherfuck the big three. Nigga, it's just Big Me.
And just a couple days ago, J. Cole has clapped back.
Your first shit was classic, your last shit was tragic. Your second shit put niggas to sleep, but they gassed it. Your third shit was massive, and that was your prime. I was trailing right behind, and I just now hit mine. Now I'm front of the line with a comfortable lead. How ironic, soon as I got it, now he wants something with me. Well, he caught me at the perfect time. Jump up and see why I got here off of bars, not no controversy. Funny thing about it, bitch, I don't even want the prestige. Fuck the Grammys, cause them crackers ain't never done nothing for me. Ho, slugs took my nigga's soul. Drugs took another one. A rap beef ain't realer than the shit I seen in Cumberland. He averaging one hard verse like every 30 months or something. If he wasn't dissing, then we wouldn't be discussing, huh?
So I'm calling this round one because I think this is going to be a series of songs on both behalfs. I'm hearing K-Dot has like three songs recorded. I don't know if that's just rumors. So the benefits of me being around industry folks is I hear some things. Okay. And what I'm hearing is that this is going to be a nice battle. I think everyone has several tracks lined up. And I am recording this on Saturday. Dreamville is happening today. My prediction, you're listening to this on probably Tuesday. I either sound very outdated and misinformed, or I'm just recapping what happened and didn't give enough information. Either way, I'm losing, but I just want to give my thoughts.
Y'all heard that bazooka that was dropped on the motherfucking game, right? So all of this time of me moving on my own accord, for the first time I was tested. Why am I tested? Because I got the world and I got my niggas like, what you gonna do, Cole? Boy, I must have had 1,000 missed calls. Oh my fucking God. Niggas want to see blood. And I was conflicted because, one, I know my heart, you know what I mean? And like, I know how I feel about my peers, these two niggas that I just been blessed to even stand beside in this game, let alone chase their greatness, right? So I felt conflicted because I'm like, bro, I know I don't really feel no way, but the world want to see blood. So I say all of that to say, I moved in a way that I feel spiritually feel bad on me. Like I try to like jab my nigga back and I try to keep it friendly. But at the end of the day, when I listen to it and when it comes out and I see the talk, that shit don't sit right with my spirit. That shit disrupts my fucking peace. So what I want to say right here tonight is, in the midst of me doing that and in that shit, trying to find a little angle and downplay this nigga's fucking catalog and his greatness, I want to say right now tonight, how many people think Kendrick Lamar is one of the greatest motherfuckers to ever touch a fucking microphone? Dreamville, y'all love Kendrick Lamar, correct? As do I. So I just want to come up here and be like, publicly be like, bro, that was the lamest, like, goofiest shit. And I say all that to say, it made me feel like 10 years ago when I was moving incorrectly. You know what I mean? I pray that my nigga really didn't feel no way. And if he did, my nigga, I got my chin out. Take your best shot. I'm gonna take that shit on the chin, boy. Do what you do. You know what I mean? Like, all good. Like, it's love.
Well, without further ado, we gotta let my homie give out his thoughts. Cliff Washington has some words to say. I mean, he sounds way more exciting than me blabbing. So why don't we get right into that? This is my interview with the one and only Cliff Washington. My first question I like to ask everyone is, what is your favorite rap line?
Oh, man. What is my favorite rap line? Yeah. I feel like it's probably going to be something from either like MF Doom or okay, like Mos Def or something like that. Ah, damn, on the spot.
Anyone that sticks out, I know this always gets everyone. But that's good. No one has said an MF Doom or
really?
Most Def line yet. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's dope.
Living off borrowed time, the clock ticks faster. That'll be the hour they knock the slick blaster. Dick Dastardly, a Muttley, a sick laughter, a gunfight, and then come the cut, the misc master, ICE, Cole. Okay, that's not the most I can remember from accordion. Accordion from Mad Villain. I might be misquoting a little bit too.
That is a classic album. And fun fact about that album, I just saw a video recently that said that that album is actually increasing in streams from a younger demographic. So like it's crazy.
That's
like
crazy.
An album that came out for like in our generation had lots of buzz, kind of like was the underground classic. Now, like on a more mainstream level, like this younger generation is all into it. I think it's still that cool underground record to have, but yeah, long live Doom, man.
Yeah, and I don't know if you saw on like socials, it hit the 20th anniversary of Mad Villain. So, and I think did it just turn gold or something like that? Because all the tension that it has now. I mean, I still remember when it came out. I was driving in my mom's Acura. I bought the CD from, I don't know if it was from a Tower Records or FYE or what it was, but I grabbed it and played it in my mom's 2001 Acura TL, and I was just mesmerized from jump.
Living off borrowed time, the clock tick faster. That'll be the hour they knock the slick blaster. Dick Dastardly and Muttley with sick laughter. A gunfight and they come to cut the mix master.
Welcome to the show. It's called Rel and Friends, and it's a podcast where I interview my friends who are creatives who do things creatively for fun and for a living. First, can you introduce yourself and what like creative avenues you participate in?
So my name is Cliff Washington. I am a brand strategist and creative consultant, amongst the other things that I do. Those are my two main concentrations, but I dabble also in product design. I dabble in illustration. I dabble in music production. So, you know, it runs the gamut of creative things that I do. I won't go as far as to say I have creative ADD, but, you know,
I have a little creative ADD, though.
Exactly.
For sure, man. I also like to start the show with a memory that I have with the person I'm interviewing. And we have a lot of little small, random, like, meetup memories, but I think the one that sticks out is probably a little over a year ago where you helped me. I hit you up for some of your consulting, and you helped me organize my thoughts around a brand strategy for my company, Art of Storytelling, which essentially became this, Rel and Friends. I remember seeing your LinkedIn post that you did that service, and it was something that I really needed at the time. So, yeah, man, thank you. This is all because of you, man.
I mean, it's very gratifying to hear, and I'm glad that we're able to go through that engagement, and I'm glad I was able to help you out with the direction. And I don't know if I've had this type of full circle where it's okay, I'm engaging in the thing that I was helping the person with.
I feel like this
is the first time, you know?
That's dope, man. That's dope. So yeah, I highly recommend the service, and we can get into that a little bit later. But yeah, it was a huge help of mine to figure out how I want to strategize content. But yeah, so let's talk about you. First of all, can you just talk about your background a little bit, like where you're from and like early creative influences?
I'm originally from Saratoga Springs, New York, which is a small city in upstate New York. My mom is basically from the Midwest, and my dad grew up in Brooklyn. And my dad's side and my mom's side, to a certain degree, is very creative. A lot of R&B played in the household, mainly jazz and gospel in the household. And then one of my older brothers, he was an artist. And my grandmother on my mom's side, she was a painter. So I grew up with influences in the household, creatively, from music to illustration and art overall. And then also, you know, I was a mid to late 80s, early 90s kid. So the influence from like Looney Tunes and Saturday morning cartoons and comic books, that was all there. So I took all that in, and that really influenced a ton of drawing in my childhood. I was very much into playing basketball and everything. I feel like I was on the path to hype beast, but never quite made it to hype beast, you know, because I had all the things. And then, you know, growing up in hip hop too, like, I'm not ashamed of it. Like, my first influence in hip hop was MC Hammer, because that's, you know, what my parents thought was appropriate and clean. So it was from that point that, you know, I got introduced to other stuff. But anyways, that's the creative influence. And I was fortunate enough to grow up in an area where they had a good amount of school funding. Yeah. I think I was in 9th or 10th grade when I first got introduced to Mac computers and Adobe Suite and Photoshop and Illustrator. So pretty early on in my creative development, I was introduced to those creative products that we kind of take for granted today and that have played an integral part in my career.
So this is like high school time?
Yeah, this is high school time. Yeah. But before that, it was like, you know, it was a lot of drawing, a lot of illustration, a lot of trying to make my own comic book storylines. So I was always in the artist field, you know, playing piano and violin and singing in the choir. So yeah, definitely been surrounded by arts and music.
When did you first see that these graphic design creative outlets could be lucrative, that it could be a job that you wanted to seek out?
I think it was first in high school and then in college. Like in high school, I saw it as a combination of things, because when I was introduced to Illustrator, it was like, oh, cool. So I remember the project that we had in 10th grade in graphic design class. It was coming up with like your own serial, right? So it was kind of like a package design combined with graphic design combined with illustration, because you know how we grew up. It was, you know, the illustrations of Lucky Charms and Fruity Pebbles and Cocoa Puffs and all this stuff. So it was very illustrative, but within a graphic design format. And when I saw that, I was like, oh, this is really cool, because you're taking a couple things that I love and smashing them together. And then once I got to college, I think it was around a very pivotal time within illustration, because I went to school for illustration and minored in graphic design. And I saw that a lot of illustration was becoming like digital based. So there was a generation of illustrators that were kind of becoming left behind. And a lot of the budgets, even when I was in college, were shrinking for illustration jobs, and especially, you know, when it came to photography as well and the role that Photoshop played in it. So before I graduated, I had the inkling that to be able to have a successful creative career, maybe I should put more into the graphic design side. So by the time I came out, I had a decent graphic design portfolio, and there just was a lot more jobs there within graphic design than I saw in illustration. Added to the fact that I think that by the time I got out, and I didn't really know it at the time, but the illustration work was very personal to me, and I didn't know if I wanted to really put that out there in the commercial sphere to have to take like commands from somebody else about my own illustration work.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Yeah, because as an artist, like, man, taking feedback sucks, because you put a lot of yourself into your work. So that's actually a smart move that you can just treat a little bit more transactional, and it's just more the money thing. And then illustration is a little bit more personal. Do you still do illustration type work just for fun?
Not as much as I'd like to, because right now my job is having me like kind of 24/7 working on projects that we have coming out. So I am trying to rededicate myself. It's really just about time blocking and putting that time aside to jump back into the illustration work. Because the big dream is to be able to release my own children's book, but that takes a lot of time and work.
Yeah, that sounds dope. That sounds dope. Yeah. So can you go through the places you've been, what your roles were, and then what got you up to where you're at now and the things you're doing now?
So, dude, that's like a lifetime in itself.
Yeah.
So my first real job out of college was, I think, in 07 when I had it. And I worked in apparel design. My very first job in New York was $27,000 a year.
Oh, shit.
And I worked for Freeze Apparel, which I think is still around. They had licenses for, like, I think Warner Brothers and Hanna-Barbera and Ant Hill, which used to be like this rock and roll license store. And we did a lot of graphics around that, because at the time it was very much heavy in the fashion industry, like kind of retro t-shirts. I mean, it is to a degree now, just a little bit different back then.
Yeah, like mass quantity type stuff that go into like Hot Topic and stuff like that, or
Hot Topic. I think we did Hot Topic, but more so like I think we were in Kohl's, maybe Kmart, a lot of the big box type places that may not be around anymore, but places like that. But definitely, I think Hot Topic was one of them. So it was like t-shirts, hoodies, quarter zips, even some like sweatpants. But you know what was big around the time still was the hip hop Looney Tunes stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That was like around 06 or so. It was still kind of out there, you know?
Yeah.
That was like a huge part of the business.
That's cool. Man, you only made 27,000? Like,
27,000. Yeah.
They probably made millions off of those.
They made a lot. I definitely was not equitably compensated.
Yeah, man. Yeah, no, those are the entry level, like, growing pains that we kind of have to go through, right? So, what kind of things did you do after that?
So I'll get into it real quickly, because this is actually kind of notable. When I was growing up, we got hand-me-downs from like relatives in Pittsburgh where my mom is from. So that's how I got my Carl Kanai gear, was okay. from relatives. So the job after Freeze, I got a job working at Carl Kanai, right?
Oh, wow.
So I did graphic apparel at Carl Kanai for, I think, a couple years. And I was able to go to the Magic Convention. I want to say 2010 to around somewhere in 2012. So that was definitely a notable spot because it's, you know, kind of like the irony of life. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So hey, like man, I used to love Carl Kanai growing up, like in the late 90s. I used yep. to like go everywhere to try to find that. Did you ever meet Maurice Malone himself?
No. Maurice Malone. I remember Maurice Malone because they used to have the ads in The Source, and I think mainly The Source and like Vibe magazine. You know, Maurice Malone, DaVinci. You know, all Aniche. The like, cross called Aniche, academics, like all that stuff. Drunken yeah. Monkey, remember Drunken Monkey?
yeah, those were like the nice jeans.
Yes. Yeah, that's why I said it was like I was on my path to being a hype beast, but I never quite got there.
Yeah, word. That was like the generation just before hype beast.
Yes.
Yeah, I was definitely involved in all of that.
At some point, I was working at a children's apparel, like outerwear company, and it was like the most depressing job that I ever had. I went through some kind of life stuff, and it made me rethink the course I was taking because I started to actively look for things that were more within the digital space. And I found a freelance job at Town Square Media for a digital designer. And this is back in like 2014 or so, or maybe a little bit earlier. And I got a role as a freelance designer there. And I was at Town Square for like 4 years or so. And I think that's where I really blossomed. They used to do a lot of website skins back then. So I got to cut my teeth on that because the Town Square Media, they own a bunch of radio stations across the country. And some of the more national, they're national brands. They have websites like Pop Crush and Screen Crush. And so I think some of them are still around. But they have deals with like Lucasfilm and Disney and I think Warner Brothers, Honda and like Budweiser. So on the websites, we do a lot of banner ads and skins for the websites. And sometimes they had these drop downs that would play movie trailers and such or just commercials. And you have the creative that would surround those videos. So I did a lot of stuff like that. And like I said, I worked from the more local side to the more national brands and stuff. So that was really important because that was still to this day one of the best jobs I've ever had. Worked with some good people there. That was my first foray into radio and into entertainment. While I was there, they acquired XXL magazine, right?
Okay.
So this always goes back to the hip-hop portion.
Yeah.
So when they acquired XXL, that's when I met Miranda Johnson, who's now at Tamron Hall Show. And I actually worked with her down the line, once we'll get to Essence. I worked with her at Essence, too. And then also this dude, Manny, I forget his last name, but he used to be at XXL as well. You know, I didn't have too many contacts on the XXL side when I left Town Square, but those are like two people that, you know, Miranda mostly this is the one that I'm in contact with. So I did a little bit of work with XXL there. Mostly for like the website. So I think XXL.com, there would be some like brand sponsorship stuff, or at least they would buy some ad space on XXL.com that I would do some work for. That, and I don't know if you remember the Boon Box, because that was another site.
I do remember that. Yeah.
Town Square owned. Because okay. I think my friend Tim Hotep used to write for the Boon Box, I think. So
cool. And you were doing design work for the site, or was it something else?
Yeah, I mean, it was the same thing, website skins and banner ads. But also, at some point, towards the end of my stint at Town Square, I started to get more into like user experience stuff because they had developed the app where you had the ability, if say you're at a rock festival, they developed this thing. And I mean, it's years after, so they shouldn't get mad about this. But the app would allow you to track crowd sizes at different points within the festival because there'd be like three stages or something. So you could kind of take a look at that and see between the stages and the food venues how big the crowd was and make your decision on where you wanted to go. So I helped plan out that user experience. So that was my foray into product design and user experience design.
So that's for people that were at the venue could track it? Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
That's dope. I've never heard anything like that. Okay, so after that, where did you work?
So that was Hot 97. That was right after Town Square Media. A friend of mine, he had been notified that there was a job opening for a digital designer at Hot 97 and then sent me that job because I think he had already gotten the position someplace else. So I went and interviewed there and then got a job there. And I was at Hot 97 for about 3 years. So, I mean, that's another pivotal moment in my career, because that's where I got to work at Summer Jam, you know, and do stadium graphics for the show. And then also I got to do graphic work for billboards in Times Square, where they would advertise Summer Jam, along with a whole host of other things. You know, I got to do some live illustration work that they recorded me doing for, I think it was the 20th anniversary of Biggie's death or something like that. It should still be on like the Hot 97 website and on YouTube. But, you know, you'll see my hand doing some live illustration for that. So that was
cool. Oh, that's cool. Oh, that's really cool. Like, where'd you go after in Hot 97?
The reason I left there, I mean, there was a host of reasons I left there, but I got laid off from Hot 97. And then from there, I went to Essence Media. I must say, when I think back on that, I've been fortunate, because at each step, I've had kind of pivotal moments. So at Essence, that's where I got to flex more of the motion design skills that I was developing. And then also I got to do some art direction at Essence Festival on the social side. So that was pretty cool, you know, being able to go to Essence Fest and being able to hang out. And it wasn't necessarily directly backstage, but like the backstage, like hangout area, where it's like, you know, catered and you see some notables back there and all that stuff. So that was pretty cool.
Nice, nice. And then after Essence, man, you have such a long resume here.
It's like I said, it's a lifetime, man. After Essence, it was a brief stint at Viacom. I wasn't at Viacom too long, because that's when the pandemic hit. I didn't really care for working at Viacom. I remember the offices just being very, like, kind of cold, and it was just kind of a depressing place to be. But I must say, I think the one thing that I learned at Viacom was that, because that was one of my first senior roles, and I think from that I learned the confidence to be a senior, right? And to be able to, I don't want to say flex, but speak confidently when you're talking to other seniors and higher ups, because at that point I still hadn't reached the level where I had that confidence to kind of speak as a senior. And that was kind of a rough learning lesson that I had to go through. And then also I learned there the skill to ask questions when it comes to clarifying, right? Because I think before, in the past, I didn't want to seem like I was bugging somebody. But at the same time, I didn't quite have all the information or understand all the information. So it was all about confidence, right? So I think I learned that. Even Viacom wasn't a great place to work for me. That's what I took away from it and what I was able to use going forward.
You got some leadership skills there, right? Yeah. What was your position at Viacom?
I was a senior digital designer at Viacom.
Okay. So did you have direct reports?
Yes, but I had direct reports, but at the same time, it was like a weird structure. You know, we had, I think my boss was like a VP or something like that. Or no, I think she was a design director. So it was structured. It was like design director, senior designer, and then like digital designers underneath me.
Okay, cool, cool. And then after that, what was after that?
I was part of a round of pandemic layoffs at Viacom.
Got it. Okay. I'm assuming you were also doing like freelance work where you could for design stuff. Can you explain your company and how that came about?
So the company I have is called Duke and Joe, and it's a brand consulting company. And that came about during the pandemic because I got laid off from Viacom, and I kind of took that as a perfect moment to do a career pivot, right? When I was at Hot 97, I saw the limits of what like graphic design and digital design could get accomplished. And oftentimes I was kind of stymied in terms of my ability to affect a lot of the planning when it came to the design deliverables that we did, because, you know, design was kind of lower on the totem pole. And I would always speak up about, maybe we can do this, maybe we can do that, maybe we should think about this a little deeper. But a lot of people, you know, they didn't really want to hear it because it was just about getting the work done. So around the same time, I think I started watching The Future on YouTube. And it was this YouTube channel run by Chris Doe and Jose Caballero. I think we talked about it before. And they had really introduced me to the idea of brand strategy and what it can accomplish within the structure of coming up with, when it came to brand building, when it came to storytelling of a brand, and when it came to ideas that influence design deliverables, right? So I started learning about that. I took a course on brand strategy and branding overall. And that then led to me creating Duke and Joe. And I would say that Duke and Joe is about helping mainly small businesses in the planning process and make sure that they're going in a direction where they have a clear idea about the goals that they're trying to accomplish, right? Basically what you and I did, right? That's the main thrust of it. And it's also about storytelling. It's about aligning with your audience. It's about understanding the aspirational audience that you're trying to reach, because, you know, I think that's oftentimes the biggest thing that I hear when I'm brand planning with clients is they have an audience that they're trying to reach that they can't reach. So how do you go about understanding who they are, what their story is, what their needs are, and how their solutions address those needs?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Nice. Can you just talk about the importance of having a strong, like, well thought out brand identity and strategy? Why is it important for a person or a company to have that?
It's important because as you grow, if you don't have a compass as to who you're trying to talk to, and if you don't have a sharp understanding of the values that you bring to whatever industry you're in, you're kind of shooting in the dark. You know, you may occasionally hit a target, and that's, you know, sometimes the way a lot of small businesses start out. But if you're scaling, it's just not good enough, because you're constantly being led by, I'll speak in the case of like design, right? A lot of times the design is led by things that are more subjective, right? When there's no strategy behind it, it's just for the aesthetics themselves and not for the broader ideal of what you're trying to do. When you have those foundations in terms of your value proposition, a well thought out mission statement, a good understanding of what your values are, really strongly planned goal prioritization, then you are setting the foundation for a lot of forward movement. Because as we discussed in the past, many times when I talk business principles, a lot of things seem like they have equal importance in terms of what they need to get done. And we know that that's never the case. When everything seems equally important, that means nothing is important and you just kind of stay stagnant in mud. When you're forced to have to prioritize based on a certain system about what's most important, then you have the opportunity to basically make life easier for yourself.
Yeah, yeah. You make smarter decisions. You don't have to backtrack on like false pivots or something. And also when you're hiring contractors or you're building out a team, like just being able to have something on paper to share, like so everyone is somewhat aligned on it, because everyone has their own style, their own opinions. Anytime I have like strategy meetings or anything, because I'm trying to build out more media stuff, I show them the doc that we created, man, just so everyone knows, like, this is what Art of Storytelling is. All right, listen up, guys. I'm sorry to do this. I got to take a quick break from this interview to let you guys know about something very special I have going on. About 3 years ago, I created this company called Art of Storytelling. And basically, what we do is we sell cassette tapes of Slick Rick's The Art of Storytelling. Just kidding. So I run a full service production company. We do everything from ideation, pre-production, production, post-production, very much geared around solving problems through storytelling. So the next time you're in a brainstorm meeting with your boss and he says, we need to create a video to create impact or to make a splash for some sort of initiative, send him my way. I promise you'll be the hero. You'll be the office hero once they get that beautifully shot vertical video that everyone watches on their phones. Hit me up, rail.mov on IG. Chances are I have a video that you need already. Let's talk it through. All right, back to the program. You mentioned you built this during the pandemic. So I actually built Art of Storytelling during the pandemic as well. And that was also kind of a career pivot. It was something that I've always wanted to do. I wasn't laid off. I decided to leave my job, as a lot of people did during the pandemic. But yes, this is one of the best moves ever, man, because now we're living this independent life. Are you at a 9-to-5 right now, or is it mostly independent?
I am at a 9-to-5. I do okay. Like my independent stuff on the side.
Got it. Okay, cool. So you have this long history, very broad design career in all aspects of it. I want to jump into this segment called For the Love of Money. So For the Love of Money is a segment that I hope to use to help encourage transparency around money talk in the creative professional space. Out of all of your experience from fashion, from radio to other media outlets, like what industries seem like they have the better paying salaries.
Healthcare. I mean, that's where I'm at right now.
Oh, that's where you're at now.
For the full-time job. Yeah.
Got it.
I work for a healthcare marketing agency, so they pay the best out of all the industries I've worked with.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they make the most money out of everyone. So in terms of the work you do, is it as enjoyable as some of the other stuff you may have done?
In certain ways, yes. In certain ways, no. I mean, nothing is going to beat being at Summer Jam in the photo pit or, you know, at Essence Fest backstage. You know, nothing's going to beat that. But I think that overall, the company structure is better. And there's egos everywhere, but the egos are monstrous in media. So that's much better in the agency world than in entertainment.
Yeah. Those egos, man. Like, I'm still in entertainment a little bit. Like, you know, I do stuff with Rory and Maul, and they're cool, chill guys. But my experience working with media personalities or just like celebrities, it's not worth it, man. It's really not worth it. Like, just being able to drop some names and stuff. I don't know. That's my experience. I would rather work for a reputable company that treats you well and encourages you and gives you the tools to succeed and stuff as opposed to celebrities. But we'll leave that alone.
Hey, man. Never meet your heroes, man. Never meet your heroes.
100%, man. So, okay, I want to revisit the company where you became more senior level and kind of like the pain points of that. Did you ever feel a sense of imposter syndrome during that time?
Oh, the whole time, basically.
Yeah. So what changed and what was the things that you were thinking?
Oh, man. It's just that personal work, you know, doing the type of personal work where you're looking at your vulnerabilities and your more negative attributes, like squarely in the eye, and asking yourself, how did you get here? You know what I mean? And when you understand that, and I guess when you can start to grieve some of the old stuff from childhood that got you to, and when you start to be able to let that go, when you actively start to address and play a part in the healing of that stuff, then you get to a better place, because I think that builds confidence, right? And for me, it wasn't necessarily something I did on my own. The thing I did on my own was come to awareness. You know, that's the first part, because you sometimes hit a wall where it's like there's nowhere to go, and it's like all you can do is look in the mirror, right? And then at that point, it's like, all right, maybe I do need some help. Maybe I have to reach out to like a therapist or something like that. And I think that's the beginning start part of that journey. It's not like that for everybody. Everybody has their own journey, as I always say, but that was my journey. Because the imposter syndrome is that, you know, you're no good, you don't know what you're doing, and you have to understand why. And I think if you're able to accept certain things about yourself, then it's less scary, and then you can operate from a mode of like, hey, I'm good at this, I'm not good at this. Those things that I'm not good at, I can be okay with asking for help for those things, and you're able to approach jobs and people more authentically, and that's always a good thing in my mind.
Yeah. I think it's that authenticity. I had a similar situation where I was promoted to a director level, and then like all of a sudden my peers became my direct reports. Huge imposter syndrome feeling, you know, even like just backlash. People just like, why do I got to treat him like my boss now? You know what I mean? Like stuff like that. What were some challenges of being at that more senior level, dealing with more like C-suite type people that you didn't have to deal with before?
When I was in a more junior role, you didn't have to like put yourself out there in terms of your thoughts or having to kind of share your thinking process behind certain things. So when you have to do that, you also open yourself up to being judged, you know? And at that point, I was very much anti being judged. So when you're not showing up authentically and you have this like kind of weird representative that's going on your behalf, you don't seem confident. You seem sort of like, I don't know if antsy is the right word, but unsure of yourself. So when you're communicating that way, it doesn't instill confidence in other people that you know what you're doing, right? Or another part of that would be, because I'm the type of person where if something doesn't make sense now, I'm going to continuously ask for clarity. Because for me, it's worse when you're making decisions off of not being clear than making decisions off being clear. So if you have to, I hated to have to bug higher ups more than like one time about all right, what the hell did you actually mean? Because, and this is, okay, and this is actually the really good thing. I think at some point you realize that a lot of us don't understand that the way we think about things in our head isn't necessarily how it's communicated to other people. So you understand what the hell it is you're trying to communicate, but somebody else may not communicate in the same way. So I think when I understood that, it allowed me to be able to go back to people to get, you know, double and triple clarity to make sure I'm doing what needed to be done. Sometimes they may actually annoy people, but it makes me be able to do the job better. I think back at Viacom, because of my embarrassment about having to go back for extra clarity, I wouldn't ask those questions that I would need to ask and then mess up. And that would be my boss upset, and I don't understand why she's upset. And it was just like a terrible situation to be in.
Yeah, that's very interesting, man. And I definitely feel that. When you have to go back and get clarity, it's super important, and I'm not afraid to do it either. And yes, it could be annoying to them sometimes, but it's what you have to do. And when you're at those senior levels, it's more important to do that than ever. Because I think when you're more of a junior level, it's a lot more transactional. It's just like, kind of, these are the deliverables I need, just get it done. As a higher up, you have so many things you're thinking about. When your direct reports are asking you all these questions that you went over in a meeting or whatever, you get annoyed. You know what I mean? But at the junior level, you are very much supposed to be set up for success. So you have all the tools you need. There's meetings, there's, you know, tasks, calendars, whatever. At a senior level, you got to create that yourself. You know, like, you are the one creating the tasks that need to get done to accomplish the goal. So you need to be very clear, because if you're not, that's going to trickle down to your team. They don't understand, you know what I mean? And everything gets all messed up. So yeah, sticking more into like the growing pains moment throughout your whole career, can you give me a big L moment? Like, what was a time where you just kind of like messed up on a project?
Okay. There's a couple, but this one stands out the most. And it was when I was at Hot 97. And I think this is a safe space. I can share this is a safe space. I was doing some type of social graphic for Funk Flex, right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I had access to the Hot 97 photo archive. So you had this stuff from like the early to mid 90s that was just amazing photography of Flex, of Enough, of Bobbito and Stretch. You know what I mean? I had access to really cool stuff. So I used a photo of Flex from back in like 94 or something like that. But I forgot that he doesn't like those old photos being used of him because he's bigger. He's bigger back then. He had lost like, I don't know, like 50, 60 pounds, something like that. And when I did the graphic and it went out to like him for approval, oh man, there was like this reply all email. And he was basically typing in the way that he talks on radio. Yeah. It was like everything was all caps. You know what I mean? I mean, I think it's pretty easy to imagine what that email sounded like.
I imagine bombs dropping.
Yeah.
like in a bad way, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Basically bombs dropping in the email, right? And it was an email out to all the people that I didn't want it to go out to, right?
Oh, man.
So that was the first L. And then the second L was, I remember I replied all to that because I was like indignant. I was like, you know, why are you talking to me like you're my daddy or something like that?
I said, oh, shit. You're
I don't remember. Yeah. I don't remember exactly what I said, but that was the beginning of the end.
Oh, man. Yeah, see, and that's the thing with dealing with, when you're working with celebrities, like, that's the stuff you have to deal with. You know what I mean? Like, those certain things, it can get as nitpicky as, like, oh, can you Photoshop the little hair that's sticking out on the side? You know what I mean? It's stuff like that, and I just don't have time for that, man. What is a lesson learned from that?
As much as you don't like to, you really have to consider the politics of a particular company that you're at. You know, I'm not huge on politics, but at the same time, I know they're necessary. So it's like wherever you get, that's like job number one. Once you get to a new company or a new client, new engagement, whatever, it's like, what is the politics of the situation? Like, say I'm doing a brand strategy engagement and it's a team of five people. Who's the decision maker? Who is the person that is like project lead that gets shit done? Who is like maybe the quiet person that has a lot of good ideas? What is their relationship like to the decision maker? You have to really understand those little things because they're important. Because if you don't understand them, then I think it's much easier to make those mistakes where, not that you say something out of turn, but if you don't understand the dynamics, then it's harder to get buy-in to a lot of stuff. You know, it can make that buy-in can either make engagement super rough or smooth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh man, I have a lot of friends in radio, and I gotta say, like, out of all the industries that I've been around, it's just the worst industry to be in. It's like you deal with that stuff, you deal with salespeople telling you what to do, and then like at the end of the day, the art you put out is something you're most likely not happy with.
Some of the worst and best stuff happened at Hot 97. So I did the Times Square billboards for Summer Jam in like 2017, I think it was. I feel like within a variety of careers, when you make it to a Times Square billboard, you're just like, oh my God, you know, you kind of made it. So I remember the day that it came out, and it was running for like, I want to say a weekend. And during my lunch break, I went down to Times Square and like took all of these pictures of the billboards in Times Square. And it was like right there. I don't know if it was it 40-something street or was it up by 50? I can't remember. It was in the 40s somewhere. But anyways, I went there and like I took all these pictures of it, and it's on my website too. And that was like a super high. I sent it out. I think I posted on at the time like Facebook and probably Instagram too, and sent it to family members. And that was just something I was really proud of because I.
That's really cool.
If you would have told me that was, you know, 15 in my bedroom reading the Source, that I would have like a Summer Jam billboard in Times Square, I would have told you that you were crazy. You
know? Yeah, right. That's such a pinnacle for a designer, man. Or just anyone in media to get up on the Times Square screen. That's insane, man. That's dope. Okay, let's jump into a segment called Scope Creeps. So scope creep is a term that creative professionals use to describe when a client's expectations or deliverables increase over time without any conversation about money or time compensation. Do you have any story where you had a project where the scope just kind of like increased over time?
Yeah, and I mean, there's been many throughout the years, but I hadn't done freelance steadily for quite a while before the pandemic. During the pandemic, like I was saying, I had done a bunch of freelance gigs, and it ranged from design to brand strategy work. But this one engagement I had with a group therapy practice, and it was a person that I had knew previously. And towards the end of the engagement, outside of the agreed upon deliverables, she had started to ask for other stuff. I can't remember exactly what it was. I don't remember if it had something to do with like banner ads or websites or it was something else, but
deliverables though.
Yeah, it was more deliverables. Okay. By that time I had enough experience where I set myself up where I could like deal with that right away. So I remember one meeting, like the meeting after, I brought up that in our statement of work, we had clearly laid out what the deliverables were for the time period in which we had to do the work. And then number two, within the contract, it very specifically states exactly what the process is. If there's going to be a scope increase, how much money-wise that's going to cost you, right? So once I went over that again with her within the meeting, then it just was like completely off the table.
No, wow. Okay, this is valuable right here because we get a lot of these stories, but we don't mention things like scope of work and stuff like that. So I think a lot of people that listen to the podcast are probably like more junior level. It's a junior level, probably at a company, but do some freelance stuff. Can you explain what a statement of work is and the importance of it?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so a statement of work, and this may not be the super correct technical definition, but this is the one I go by. Statement of work just says exactly what you're going to do. I believe it has also the price in it that I set up and the timeline, and it outlines who you are as a vendor, who the client is, I'm trying to think what else, who the mode of contact is on the client side and who the mode of contact is on the vendor side. So we get all that straightened out in the SOW. But the main point of the SOW for me is exactly what we agreed that we're going to do. What our project number is, I have that in there. I'm probably going too technical, but I have the project number in there. And then, that's basically it. But then, you know, I have the master contract agreement as well. And that stipulates everything when it comes to where I can share this work, if I can't share this work, if I'm indemnified, if there's any travel costs related to it, insurance, blah, 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 like all that other master contract stuff that can last not only for one particular engagement, but could potentially last for engagements in the future.
Yeah, yeah. When you're drafting these things, do you have any resources that you use to to make them, or are you drafting these completely yourself from scratch?
Oh, it was definitely was not from scratch. So I got my templates from, this is going back to the future. I got my templates from the future. This is about 4 or 5 years ago. Chris Doe was nice enough to put out, at the time, I think it was free templates for SOWs and for master agreements. So I don't think that I paid for those. I think they were free resources at the time. I don't think they're free anymore on thefuture.com, but that's where I got. And also, what is that one contract called? It's when I need to bring on contractors. I have agreements for that as well.
Cool. Yeah, so yeah, I bring that up just to say, like, there are resources out there. I bought one from Tropicolor. They also own, like, Prism Lens and stuff like that. But I bought, like, a whole package of, like, full-on production forms, call sheets, project management tools, and it has scope of works, contracts. Yeah, and I think it was only, like, $50. So, yeah, anyone listening, look up some of those resources because you do not have to get a lawyer to draft this for you. You don't have to try to come up with it from scratch. Like, there's a lot of tools. You just drop a little bit of money. It's well worth it, man. I use all those all the time.
For the longest time, I did have, like, some like one pager that I was using, but it wasn't as specific as a SOW master agreement or Schedule B or whatever. The reason I didn't have it that specific because I was afraid of scaring the client away, right?
Yeah.
If I showed them too much paperwork, I was just too small and they wouldn't want to sign it. But a lot of those engagements turned into headaches anyway. And a lot of times I got bit in the ass because I didn't have that paperwork.
Yeah. It's about protecting yourself. And I do feel like when you are working with especially bigger companies, I feel like they respect you more when you have everything kind of in control and it's like you're thinking of everything. So yeah, highly advise, get yourself some of these templates. And it forces you to think of everything too, because as you go through everything, it's like, oh, I didn't think about that part. Let me fill this in. You know what I mean? Okay, cool. So to round it out, I want to ask some quick rapid fire questions. So you have experience in both working corporate, the 9-to-5 job, and you're also doing your independent thing. The major versus independent question, what do you prefer?
I think the preference would be independent, but it takes a lot of work to be able to sustain yourself independently. Having a full time is great for the stability, but I mean, it depends on who you are. You know, what do you want? For me, the goal eventually is independent, but until I reach that point where I'm ready to make that leap fully, it's kind of a hybrid at this point.
Dope. Yep. And what does the next 5 years look like to you?
Hopefully, creatively, in the next 5 years, it would be great to be able to function fully independent, being able to, like, okay, because I know that we talked about speaking on numbers, right? It would be great in the next 5 years if I was able to run my business at the very least $100,000 a year.
Nice, yeah.
You know, and I have a cadre of clients that is kind of a rotating amount of work that, you know, will keep me busy and the company busy overall. But then also making sure that I'm putting time needed to reach out to prospective clients or an audience that I might not be serving currently, but I'd like to work with. You know, I've worked with climate startups. I've worked with video producers such as yourself. I've worked with even, you know, very small community organizations. I've worked with, like I said, therapy practices. I've worked with executive coaches. I've worked with quite an array of people. So I really do enjoy working with small businesses that are trying to get off the ground, whether they be in media or trying to come up with climate solutions. I would like to get a little bit deeper into the tech space, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Where do you find the most success in terms of outreach? Like, how do you find new clients?
I want to say the most success I've had, it's through referrals. That's the most success, is because, you know, somebody will mention that I helped them do something, and then they'll like set up an intro and have a conversation, and it just kind of goes from there. And if I had to pick a certain platform online, it would probably be, I guess, Instagram. I get a lot of conversations started on that. It's weird. I have a lot of recruiters reach out on, like, you know, LinkedIn, or just I'll start conversations on LinkedIn. But I think I've actually had a bit more success on Instagram.
Okay. It's interesting. So, like, I asked that because I think the way I discovered that you were doing this work was you were releasing content. Was it on Instagram or LinkedIn? I thought it was LinkedIn. Was it LinkedIn?
I want to say you reached out on Instagram.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So it was Instagram.
Yeah.
But yeah, as a contractor myself, it's definitely word of mouth and referral that I get most of my clients from. But I think there is an importance to engaging your current network somehow through some sort of content strategy, which is what got me to reach out to you. Okay, cool. If you could say anything to the young you, what would it be?
Okay, so if I could say something to when I was a youth, it would be surrounding the whole like confidence thing, you know, to as early as possible to be curious about why you show up the way you do in the world.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, yeah.
That's
yeah.
kind of the that's the mic drop right there.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Okay, and then AI, do you fear it or do you use it?
I use it.
Yeah, in your design work, you use it?
Yeah, I've explored AI, well, more specifically within Adobe's generative AI. I think it's called like Firefly or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's integrated to like, one example I can give is expanding backgrounds that in terms of campaign art that I might be, that may be part of like a website build or something like that. So, you know, the image that we get may only go out so far, but the requirements for the hero section of a website might need that image to be bigger. So for like, I would say, not necessarily specking purposes, but for like look and feel purposes, you might use generative AI to expand that background, plug it in to get the okay from the client. Then they can go back to the guys that made you the 3D illustration stuff to make it the way that we set it up through generative AI.
That's cool. Yeah, I have a friend that used it to turn a 16:9 video into a vertical video without losing any quality. I think he shot on the beach, so it added more sand. And it looked like the composition was made for that. It's amazing. So,
which resource did he use?
He used Fireflies, but it was a static image, but you couldn't tell. He put it under video, and you couldn't tell that it was like a still image under video. Yeah, it's great for stuff like that. Okay, cool. And my last question, it's a segment called Drop a Gem on 'em. Man, if you had any knowledge, inspiration, or even resources you could give to a young designer that might be interested in one or more of the industries that you've chose to pursue, what would it be?
You know, it's really good to try everything when you first start out, because I was in apparel, I dabbled in some of the digital stuff, but then also I was doing my freelance stuff. I was messing around with some motion design stuff to stay creatively open. But at the same time, it's like, how can you hone your passion into this one thing? And I don't mean this to limit anybody, right? But how can you make what you do and who you are valuable to an organization if you're, you know, going to the full-time route? Or even if you're not going the full-time route when it comes to the value that you bring as a independent contractor, freelance, or as a single or a sole proprietor, right? So brought the creative aspect of myself, the strategic aspect of myself, the curious aspect of myself when it comes to user experience into the product design work that I do. So it's a little bit expanded beyond what I was doing when I was purely in creative or in the art department. So I think it's about, because like you said, a lot of us have creative ADD. How can you take all those different influences and hone that into this thing that people are going to find useful, valuable, while giving you some type of creative satisfaction? Because a lot of times in these jobs, especially if it's full-time, you know, there might only be 5 to 10% of it that might be creatively satisfying, but you should be able to get something from every position that you have, right? Something that's gonna help you to learn something and take you to whatever that next level is for you. So it's like, it's part of the ikigai thing, right? You know, what's valuable, what's needed in the market, what's something that you really enjoy. It's about getting that, whether it's for, I mean, more so for you, maybe your personal stuff, but in part also for the more commercial stuff. You know, how can you reach your own little ikigai?
Yeah. Dope, man. Well said. I love that. Yeah, on that note, we can wrap it up, man. I want to thank you so much for joining the podcast. Yeah, and I'll see you around, man.
Thanks for having me, man. I really enjoyed this. This was fun.
And that right there was my interview with Cliff Washington. Man, that was fun. That was a lot funner than I expected. No offense, Cliff. But like, anytime someone talks about MF Doom and like classic hip hop people and moments that happen with them, like, I get really excited. So Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And like I said, Cliff is very much a very organized person when it comes to media strategy. Yeah, even just explaining the importance of having a strong brand and a strong direction. So if you are creating your own business, your own brand, or even just trying to do your own sort of content creation to promote yourself, I would highly recommend looking to him for advising. Very well worth the time. But I told you about the voicemails we got too. We got a voicemail. Let's hop right into that.
Calling, calling, calling. I'm calling my brother, I'm calling. Answer your phone, I'm calling. Conversation. My words connect, my mind connects to York, and we connect. Answer.
Yo, what up? This is Ali. So, usually when we do a piece of art or a project, you know, anything that's visual or audio, any sort of client work, we usually do it with an intended audience in mind. So, my question is if you were doing an art project or any sort of artistic expression, and if you knew that it wasn't going to be released to the public, what would that project be? Or what would that piece of art look like?
Thank you, Haleen, aka Halo. You may have remembered, if you've been following the podcast since the beginning, Halo was interview number 2. And he was so excited to send a voicemail once he found out that we were taking voicemails. And this is a good question. And you know, these last two questions have been really good. I think I'm going to start opening them up on social media. Look to that soon. There's going to be a whole social media revamp, but that's neither here nor there. But okay, if I had to make an art project that I know nobody would see, what would it be? Well, Halo, Haleen, I make art all the time that no one sees. I think every single day I'm coloring with my daughter, Imani. And I doodle a lot now. And that has been a lot of fun. I used to doodle a lot when I was younger, when I used to try to be a graffiti artist or just always had like a book, or I'm supposed to be taking notes, but I'm drawing in class. So I say that was one thing. But if I was going to make like a true like piece of art that I spend a lot of time on, knowing that no one would hear, it would probably be some beats, some music. I used to be a beat maker. I have tons of beats that no one has heard, but that's an art form that was, to me, was always pretty personal, and it's just a way of self-expression. And I also never really wanted people to hear it. I only had a select few people that I would let hear it, and if it was good, if I got the okay from that little crew of people, then I would like upload on SoundCloud. But if I didn't get that, then I wouldn't upload it. But I think, yeah, it would be music. It would definitely be music. And I want to get back into that. But what about you guys? What would you make? What would you make where you don't care about the likes? You don't care about the shares or comments? You just want to make something and just sit on it. Just make something because it makes you feel good. Great question, Halo. Thank you for that. But on that note, we need y'all to call in to the voicemail. Voicemail number is 646-926-3885. Or you can email a voice note to realandfriendspod@gmail.com. Or you can hit me on the DM with a voicemail, a voice note of some sort. Rel.mov. We also got rel.friends on IG. You can hit up John Reyes, Stank Palmer, everywhere. Send him a voice note even. And you can have a lovely week. Until next time, my friends. This is Relin Friends.